99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.
Hey, what's up now?
Hey, brother, what's up?
This is hey, a how
big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
like, stop.
World beyond. This is Salon's Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBAI's Morning Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? Catherine Davis is in for Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. Tuesday, it's a few degrees warmer, and we brighten up a bit under a mix of sun and clouds. Wednesday, it's a bit chillier and a washout. But the rest of the week, right on through the weekend, it's dry in the high 30s, mid-40s, with a mix of sun and clouds, and no snow. As has been widely reported, New York City is now in its fourth longest run without snowfall, with 313 days without any of the white stuff. That's not good. On the COVID front, the New York Times reports that nationally, cases, hospitalizations, and test positivity are all down by 20% over the last 2 weeks. That's good. These improving conditions are most evident here in our region, where new cases are down by as much as 30% in New Jersey and New York. This morning, we'll get an update from Dr. Celine Gounder, one of the nation's leading public health experts, on just where we are in the COVID continuum in terms of community and occupational health. Dr. Gounder is a senior fellow and editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News. She's written for the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, the Guardian, and the Washington Post, as well as Reuters. And all of this medical journalism is grounded in her ongoing commitment to caring for patients on the wards of New York's Health and Hospitals, Bellevue Hospital. In the second half of the show, we'll speak with Sarah Director, a leading 9/11 World Trade Center attorney with Barish & McCary, about the latest developments for women who were exposed to the toxic air in Lower Manhattan, Western Brooklyn on 9/11 and in the several months of the Bosch cleanup. Sarah's firm has been advocating for 90 women who contracted uterine cancer due to their presence in the Lower Manhattan on 9/11 and for the months of the recovery, and for more than 20 years, could not get recognized. Last week, uterine cancer was finally classified as a World Trade Center cancer, qualifying those who contracted it for free health care and financial compensation. I am honored to be joined by Dr. Celine Gounder. Good morning, Dr. Gounder.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay, first, I wanted to extend my condolences to you and your family for the loss of your husband, Grant Wall, a brilliant sports journalist with a social conscience who died while he was covering the World Cup.
Thank you, Bob.
So by way of introduction for our listeners, Dr. Gounder is a senior fellow and editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News, who has written for the New York Times, the New Yorker, and just about anybody who's publishing anything of value. And all of this medical journalism is grounded in your ongoing commitment to caring for patients on the wards of New York's Health and Hospital, Bellevue Hospital. I first became familiar with your work when you were providing essential subject matter expertise on the community Zoom calls with Mark Levine, who is now Manhattan Borough President, but during the most intense days of the pandemic was chair of the City Council's Health Committee. You remember those?
I do. Seems like a lifetime ago in many ways. It's really been a blur the last couple of years of trying to deal with this pandemic.
So where are we now? Is it correct to say the COVID pandemic is over? I was at 4 o'clock this morning, was looking for a word, and I came up with continuum. So where are we?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think continuum, I think spectrum. We are clearly not in the emergency phase that we were in 2020, 2021. We're in a much better place. We have vaccines, obviously. We have therapeutics like Paxlovid. We have access to at-home rapid tests. If you remember in the early days of the pandemic, it was really hard to get a test. And the population immunity is at a very different level now, which leads the risk to drop dramatically. But there are certain groups that remain at very high risk. 90%, over 90% of deaths are now occurring among the elderly. Earlier in the pandemic, everybody really was at risk. If you go back the summer of 2021, half of deaths were in people under 65. And that has really shifted now, where we're seeing the deaths really concentrated among the elderly and other high-risk groups include immunocompromised people and pregnant women. And so those three groups really do have to stay more vigilant than the rest of us. And hopefully the rest of us can do what we can to protect those high-risk groups.
So we have a lot of essential workers who tune in. And so that's transport, emergency services, education, as well as retail and service sectors. In fact, throughout this, we do a COVID reading before the weather. I know it's hard to give universal medical advice because so much depends on each individual's health profile, as you just outlined. But what would you recommend frontline workers do to reduce the risk of contracting an infectious disease like COVID?
Well, there are a few things. Certainly staying up to date with your vaccinations. I think a lot of people have been confused about whether they should get a booster or not. Is it worth it? Especially if you're in one of those three groups I outlined, if you are over 65, if you are immunocompromised, if you are pregnant, absolutely, 100% keep up with your booster shots. And even for others, it will certainly reduce your risk further. So if you're not wanting to miss work and wages associated with that, getting a booster shot will certainly help reduce your risk of having to miss out on work. Some of the other things you can be doing, though, includes masking. And I know that's become less popular, so to speak. But I think it's important to remind folks that masks really do work. And if you are going to mask, make sure that you're using one of those higher quality masks. So those include KN95, KF94, and N95. Those masks are much more effective than a surgical or cloth mask in reducing your risk. And then some of the other things to be doing also include, if you're in a place where you're able to open windows, have an air filtration unit running that may or may not be in your control, and then making use of testing. If you or people you work with or other family members are sick, if you stay home, and you know, again, this is going to depend on your workplace, you get paid sick leave. But if you are able to stay home and not spread it around to others, you ultimately reduce the risk for everybody.
I was just wondering, you said sickly, so I would imagine that you're a proponent of people having the opportunity to avail themselves of paid sick leave.
Well, we know that having paid sick and family medical leave, so in other words, if you're sick, you can stay home. If a loved one is sick, you can stay home to help take care of them. Or maybe it's a child who just needs looking after if they have to stay home sick. It really does. It has been shown to reduce the risk of COVID transmission, for example. And then also, it's not just COVID, right? People have any number of medical issues themselves. Their family members may have. And we know that in the United States, we have a lot less support for any number of kinds of caregiving, whether it's for children, for the elderly, for people who are sick or disabled or homebound. And paid sick leave, paid sick and family medical leave would help not just for COVID, but for any number of health and life stresses that working folks are dealing with.
So you won't mind, of course, if I cut a bit of this out and send it to the railroad brothers and sisters in the union still looking for the sick days, do you, Doctor?
I think any profession where you have to be working, in person, it's not virtual. I think it becomes that much more important to provide folks paid sick and family medical leave to reduce the risk of disease transmission and also just to support them through what are difficult stretches in life, right?
Wow. 3 years now into this whole thing, we still don't have a grasp on precisely how many individuals died from COVID as a consequence of this workplace exposure, particularly in those first several months before the vaccines were available. Individual unions have tried to track it anecdotally, and we have the essential reporting by Guardian and Kaiser Health News about the 3,600 healthcare workers that died in that first period of time, that first year. Do we need to do more research here so that we can look at the issues like potential improvements to workplace ventilation? I mean, we don't really, you know, what gets measured gets managed. We don't really know. Do we need to answer some of those questions?
There is movement towards setting some sort of standards or at least recommendations. This has been a slow process within the federal government, but we anticipate that come this spring, there will at least be some basic guidance as to what level of ventilation is being recommended. And that will help, because even if it's a recommendation and not a requirement, it gives people something to target, to try to achieve, to measure, you know, if there is some places are higher risk than others, in a meaningful way.
Now, there's a GAO study out that raised the possibility there's 23 million Americans could be dealing with some aspect of long COVID. What do we know about long COVID? In some cases, it could be disabling in terms of work, which is what I'm hearing. I understand from my healthcare and first responder unions sources that they have members that have indeed been sidelined and have had to file worker comp claims. What do you know about this?
Well, we use the word continuum spectrum at the top of the show, and similar with long COVID, you have a continuum or spectrum of disease. For some people, it's pretty mild, but for other people, it can indeed be disabling. Some of the more disabling forms of long COVID include this brain fog, where people don't think as clearly, and it becomes very difficult, especially if you're doing work that requires concentration, that can be very difficult. There's also a condition called POTS, P-O-T-S, in which your blood pressure drops when you stand up, and so you become dizzy and lightheaded. And so you have people who have very difficult time getting up from laying down. As soon as they stand up, they feel lightheaded. They sometimes even pass out. And so that's another example of one of these more disabling forms of long COVID. Some people cannot work, and there have been challenges. I think it's getting better in terms of being able to get on disability and get some of the support. There are specialized centers that are, here in New York City, at places like NYU and Mount Sinai, that have specialized centers to help support and treat people who have long COVID. And a big part of that is that there may not be a cure, but you can help manage symptoms and also provide people with those social and economic supports to help them through this.
So public health advocates are concerned that Congress has not followed up on requests from the Biden administration for additional COVID monies, particularly in that $1.7 trillion omnibus bill that $858 billion for defense. Should we be concerned that there's not that follow-up money? What's at stake?
Well, the estimates have been, they're probably estimates from about a year ago now, that to properly, holistically address COVID in this country would cost us about $100 billion a year to do all the things that the experts have outlined really should be done. And that includes everything from the pharmaceuticals, so drugs, vaccines, diagnostics, to things like improving ventilation, particularly in schools and other high-risk settings, to things like at least some level of paid sick and family medical leave. And so Congress is not giving any new money at this stage. And so it means, to some degree, having to take from other programs. It means really having to make some very, very difficult decisions. And it means that we're at a place where most of the funding is going to be going towards things like vaccines and not for some of the more holistic approaches that would help not just for COVID, but for sort of the broader array of viral respiratory infections and other infectious diseases.
Well, we've got to focus on that. Initially, there's been some support in the U.S. Senate to convene an independent 9/11 style commission to study our nation's response to COVID, but it appears it's not generated sufficient support. Would you endorse such an inquiry?
I think it just depends on how it is conducted. If it is politicized and is really more about grandstanding than about getting to real policy changes and investment in those policy recommendations, it just really depends on if it was a worthwhile endeavor or a worthwhile process. I think, unfortunately, in the current congressional environment, it is very likely to be a politicized process.
No, I was just going to say that that the other thing is the reality is that this is all happening as we're still a country that is spending the most for healthcare of similarly situated, developed and wealthy countries with the poorest outcomes.
That's right. And, you know, I think to be stepping back and thinking a little bit more about how we spend our money, how we allocate it, questions of cost effectiveness. So what that really means is where do you get the most bang for your buck? And we've been very reluctant to have those kinds of conversations in this country. Other countries like the UK, for example, do incorporate cost effectiveness analyses into their policy making. And we just have not wanted to go there much of the time.
How do people follow your work? How can they keep track of what you think is important?
You can find me on Twitter. It's at Celine Gounder, CelineGounder.
Listen, thanks so much for taking the time. We planned this thing like months ago. I hope we can have you back in a few months because we covered a lot of territory very quickly.
Thanks so much, Bob, and good day to your viewers.
All right, thanks. That's Dr. Celine Gounder. We'll take a musical break, and then we'll be back with your calls.
The morning.
I understand we've got some callers on the line. Good morning, call. Where are you calling from? What's on your mind? What's your name?
Hey, it's Russ. I'm up in White Plains.
Hey, okay. So what's on your mind?
Hey, well, I have a few disagreements with the woman that was just on. Obviously,
Dr. Gounder, you mean?
Yeah, Miss Gounder.
Yeah.
Her husband dropped dead, and she said it was an aneurysm. And, you know, I just don't believe a word she says. I wanted to ask her how she felt about weaponizing loneliness, because ostracizing people who didn't conform by wearing masks and getting vaccines, that was terrible. They were trying to make people conform, and it weaponized loneliness in an already horribly depressed society. But I want to ask you, do you notice, you know, when they came out with these vaccines, they competed. Oh, it's 91% effective. Then the other one said it's 95% effective. Now we know they're not really effective at all. They're not effective, and they damage people. And I'd like to ask her also if she thinks, you know, having these vague effects, these catch-all symptoms, does it encourage psychosomatic people and hypochondriacs? Do they ever study how many people are coming out of the woodwork with false symptoms? That. And one last thing, I want to cite an article from the, because you're a newspaper person, from the New York Post, April 10th, 2020, the front page article is about Potter's Field burial sore in trenches on Hart Island. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So about five paragraphs down, it says, in this article, officials did say that the ramped-up Hart Island burials are meant to clear out precious morgue space that is likely to be needed as the number of coronavirus dead continues to rise. That told me it was all fake. The people they were burying hadn't died of COVID. They were clearing out the morgue, but making it look like there was basically, concentration camp conditions. But, Bob, thank you.
Ruskin, I do think I've given you, your views on this are well known. I mean, you're a personality in your own right on the radio. And so I just have to say to you, because I do have other calls, that what you're doing is you're imputing, I have nothing but the highest regard for the integrity of Dr. Gounder. So it comes down to that personal thing. And so
I'm sorry.
This is just as personal. And so I understand your point of view. I'm glad you called in. I think you did a great job getting across all your points. And call again. I do have to go on to another caller. Thank you. Oh, caller, do I hear a caller on the line?
Can you hear me? I think I might.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Hi. Go ahead. Where are you calling from? What's your name?
Hi. My name is Sade. I'm calling from New York. I'm just calling just to make a slight, polite point of correction, regarding POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. It's one of the most common post-viral syndromes that we're seeing coming out of COVID-19. And it's not related to blood pressure. That's a common misconception. The diagnostic criteria has to do with beats per minute, heart rate with heart rate. So if you have an increase in heart rate of 30 beats per minute or more when you go from laying to the upright position, that is POTS.
Brilliant. It sounds like are you a medical professional? You've got such detailed knowledge.
No, just a POTS patient.
Listen, there's no better expert. Thank you so much for calling. And please call again. I do have, we've got quite a few calls. Thank you for calling. Caller?
Background.
Thank you. Thank you. We have, another caller, I believe. What's on your mind? What's your name?
Hi. My name is Paul.
Yes. Great.
I just wanted to, unfortunately, I think you let the good doctor go, but I wanted to know either from her or maybe what the distribution of long COVID is in the general population. In other words, is it more skewed towards older adults or kids or, what? I mean, that would have been my question to her.
Sure. The GAO study, which I will tweet out later, gives us some frame to that. I think what we're seeing is that folks that have the same high profile older folks, that's one thing I'm seeing. But that's one of the reasons why we just have a base number of 23 million. That's why I want the occupational research to be done, because as it is now, there's no central registry for this. It's very similar to what we're going to talk about in the later half of the show, around the 9/11 World Trade Center phenomena, where there was an imperative to open up Wall Street, you may remember. And so they said the air was safe to breathe, and it was not. And subsequently, tens of thousands of people have come down with cancers related to the 9/11 World Trade Center. So we're still figuring that out. And I do think that that's a central question. Thanks, and please call again. Go ahead.
23 million, total cases altogether of COVID, whether it's long COVID or just regular.
Oh, no, 23 in total potential long-term symptoms of varying severity. So one of the things I hear is from, I remember I did a story about the Uniform Postal Police. The wonderful head of that union was confined to a walker. Thank God he's back to work. I hear these anecdotal stories all the time. That's why my work at WorkBytes, we spend so much granular time, because the government really doesn't want to know this. And not to get too conspiratorial about it, but it's about businesses don't really want to know the toll. Governments don't really want to know the toll on working people. So I will continue to explore that area, because it is a pivotal question, and you're right to ask it.
Hey, thanks.
All right, we'll be back after this musical break with Sarah Director from Parrish & McCary.
We're
When I Rise. Tuesday, it's a few degrees warmer, and we brighten up a bit under a mix of sun and clouds. Wednesday, it's a bit chillier and a washout, but the rest of the week, right on through the weekend, it's dry in the high 30s, mid-40s, with a mix of sun and clouds with no snow. As has been widely reported, New York City is now in the fourth longest run without snowfall, with 313 days without any of the white stuff. It's an honor to be joined now by Sarah, director, a leading 9/11 World Trade Center attorney with Parrish & McCary, who's on the line about the latest developments for women who are exposed to the toxic air in Lower Manhattan and Western Brooklyn on 9/11 and the several months of the that followed in the botched cleanup. And we're also having on the line Karen Smith Hagman, who herself worked at 40 Wall Street and has been represented by Parrish & McCary. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so we've got a lot of ground to cover, some 20 years. We'll try to do it in compressed time. Sarah, we've spoken before about this, my work at the chief leader. Last week, uterine cancer was finally added to the list of 9/11 World Trade Center covered concerns. Why has it taken so long?
Well, first, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on to discuss this really important topic, help educate your listeners about it. And it has taken too long. It's been a very long time coming for women within the 9/11 community to finally be heard and have their illnesses recognized. The reason for it is that women were underrepresented in the initial September 11th medical studies because the focus was on first responders, and the majority of them were men. Not that women weren't first responders, there were just more men that these studies concentrated on within the FDNY. These studies did not accurately consider all the women who lived, worked, and went to school below Canal Street during the 8 months after September 11th. These studies couldn't imagine the mass amounts of people that came down with cancer, especially women. So the stories you hear on the news and the media and repeated, they're not spoken about the women. You don't see your narrative when you turn on this TV. So women were not signing up for the program because they did not think it was for them. They thought it was for the first responders. Less women in the program, less women to monitor, less women to be included in the statistics needed to draw the connection between the toxins and specific cancers.
Oh, my God. It's like a confluence of some of the systemic discrimination that we know about. I mean, the same thing's true for women with heart disease, right, historically. The failure to study the focus of insurance companies and the way that, you know, on the breadwinner, who's making the big money. And so we direct all the studies to those concerns as opposed to keeping an eye on over half the population. I wanted to say that you mentioned this small – one of the things I think we need to laugh for people is that – the World Trade Center program, one of the things, I want to make sure I get this right, first responders, as a matter of right, get screening from the World Trade Center health program, whereas survivors, those individuals who are civilians, even civil servants who are serving in non-uniform capacities but don't fall into the category of first responders, they have to exhibit symptoms first in order to get picked up by the World Trade Center health program. Could you clarify that?
Sure. So, yes, non-responders are not eligible for the annual medical exams unless they have symptoms or a diagnosis of a 9/11 illness. And then once they're certified by the program, they will get their free annual exam. Survivors, on the other hand, can also get treatments for mental health, such as anxiety, PTSD,
right,
get treated for it, and get certified for it. So if a survivor is experiencing mental health conditions as a result of returning to Lower Manhattan during the time period, they can be found eligible and they can go to the healthcare program. And then if, God forbid, they are diagnosed with a physical illness, they are already in the program and then they can get certified. By no
but of
means
course,
do we – go ahead.
No, I was just saying, but if I've done my studying correctly – ironically, the Victims Compensation Fund doesn't offer compensation for mental health issues.
That is correct. They do draw a distinction for that. But the health program offers medical treatments and pays for medical bills for it. So while you might not be getting the compensation that you would get if, God forbid, you were diagnosed with a cancer like uterine, you can still get the medical help that you need. But what I was going to say is by no means do we suggest that just because you are not suffering from a physical illness, you ignore the health program and the victim compensation fund. We urge everyone to register with the fund, and we urge everyone to collect every document you may need in the future to prove your exposure now. Because unfortunately, statistically, those, including myself, within the 9/11 community, we are just waiting for that diagnosis. And it could come this week, this year, next year, 10 years from now. But the requirements are not going to change. You have to prove you were there. So don't wait. Hopefully you collect your documentation now and you never need it. And that's what we hope for everyone. But don't wait.
That's key. And that's a takeaway here. That's a key point. Karen Smith Hagman, thank you for joining us. Tell us your story.
Sure. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I worked, as you said, in the beginning of the program at 40 Wall Street during and well after the 9/11 incident, unfortunately. And I did have some behavioral health issues, did have PTSD for a couple of years, and was on my merry way, doing well. And in June of 21, I was diagnosed with uterine cancer. And do not have Lynch syndrome, which would mean that it was a hereditary cancer, and didn't meet, really don't meet the criteria for any of the risk factors of why I would have gotten uterine cancer, but was, have been getting treatment at Memorial Sloan Kettering, including surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, et cetera, and I'm still getting treatment through an oral medication. So it's been... my daughters actually are the ones who encouraged me to apply for the World Trade Center health program when the doctors said, there's really no rhyme or reason as to why you have uterine cancer. And I just thought, okay, well, maybe it is from 9/11, even though I knew that uterine cancer was not part of the diagnostic criteria. We went over that. I looked at it a couple times, and I said, well, you never know what happens. And so I did contact the law firm and started the registration process, which is still going on. I'm still haven't been accepted, as you say. Sarah, there are a lot of documents you have to complete and gather to prove that you were there. And even though I have a case number, I don't have an approved case, if you will. I'm not getting any services through the World Trade Center Health Fund at this point.
Oh, my goodness. And I just want to commend you for your courage to come on the radio and to talk about this, because it's difficult. I mean, this was over 20 years ago, and dealing with the medical establishment by itself is traumatic. And so I'm just wondering, in terms of, have you had any success in networking? I mean, it's 40 Wall Street. What kind of work were you doing? Where'd you work?
I worked for HealthNet at the time, one of their subsidiaries, which is a health insurance company based out of California. So I worked there, I led that office, that unit, and there were, over 100 people in the office that day the planes hit, and I was actually outside when the first plane hit, walking from the PATH station to my office. And, it was, all I can say, it probably was the worst day of my life. So, and for many other people, I'm sure they feel the same way.
Have you networked with other folks? Have you been in touch with colleagues who've had similar issues?
Well, I've stayed in touch with my colleagues who we shared the day with. That's something that bonds you together, kind of like a wartime event, right? And stayed in touch with them. And, we lost, I live in Middletown, New Jersey, and we lost 37 people that day.
Right.
And I knew, three of them. So it was, it's bigger than just, okay, there was the event, and there's the downstream impact. And then, of course, there were, kids, my kids were in high school at the time. So it was a lot of things going on. But I have, you know, just started to get in touch through the SHARE program, which is a women's group, an educational program as well as a support program for women with uterine cancer. And in that group, I am the only one whose uterine cancer, you know, doesn't have an etiology except for perhaps the World Trade Center. The others have, you know, more of the higher risk symptoms that would risk profile that would have said, okay, you know, they're going towards developing uterine cancer perhaps, or it was a secondary cancer to something they'd already had.
This is such a it's so empowering to hear all the action that you're taking. Callers, if you have an anecdote or have questions, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Sarah, I know that Barish McCurry represents some 90 women in this situation. Do we have any sense of how many women may have died from this? And do families have any recourse if that's the case?
So actually, our numbers are growing daily, unfortunately, with our clients that have been diagnosed or who have unfortunately passed away from uterine and endometrial cancer. The population is greatly underestimated, and in the next few months, the numbers are going to continue to go up and up. And this is really the opportunity for women around the country to connect the dots from their 9/11 exposure to their now eligible uterine and endometrial cancer. And people that have lost someone to this cancer absolutely now have recourse. They can make a claim to the Victim Compensation Fund for their loved one's pain and suffering and death, and they can qualify to get compensation, funeral bills paid, and reimbursement of medical bills. So thankfully and finally, these families are given the financial stability and the respect they deserve. The rule was just published in the Federal Register last week, and it became automatic, which is one of the best things that I heard after all this time waiting for it to be published. Usually, once a rule is published, there is a waiting time of minimum of 30 days.
Right.
They knew cancer, it's life or death. These families, these women cannot wait around another day for the government to get it together. So thankfully, the minute it was published, women could be found eligible by the healthcare program and claims can be filed with the Victim Compensation Fund. And Barish McGarry, we've been working around the clock like we always do to ensure that every one of our clients are getting into the program and get what they deserve.
Well, and you've been also another cohort that I've written a lot about is in the aftermath of the there were two insults to the public, of course, the catastrophic attack by the planes. We shouldn't lose focus of that. But then also the EPA's decision, which came from the White House Bush administration and White House Council on Environmental Quality, to really misrepresent the nature of what was in the air there. Even now, the city of New York is refusing to release what they knew about it. One of the unfortunately caught up who are used kind of like props were all the school children. I guess it was the decision. This is at Giuliani Bloomberg period to keep open and reopen dozens of schools in the catchment area. And this is where it gets tricky because the map is not the territory. There are portions when you look at the FEMA declaration map for the purpose of World Trade Center health program issues, Western Brooklyn, which includes a lot of government offices and some schools, and Manhattan below, I believe it's Houston Street, that's what's considered the catchment for potential World Trade Center health folks, whereas the map that is for the Victim Compensation Fund that can actually give you cash compensation, that's south of Canal. I got that right? I mean, that's an important distinction for people to understand.
That is. Absolutely. And if anybody wants to see the map, they certainly can go to my firm's website, post911attorneys.com, or Google Barish McGarry to take a look at the map. But you are correct. There is a difference between who is eligible for the health care program and then who would be eligible for compensation. And the government drew a line, but certainly the dust did not obey where they put the line. It's not as if this toxic dust cloud just stopped at south of Canal and said, we're not, it's not going to travel any further. We field calls so many a day and have to explain to people that they are eligible for health care, but not for compensation because of where the government drew the map.
Wow. And I understand this, having sat through so many hearings on this, there's some crazy situations where a school will be on the other side of the road from where they've drawn the line. I mean, it is really crazy.
It absolutely is. My firm has appealed many cases where people might have worked on the north side of Canal Street, but the line would be on the south side. And through hard work, we're able to find them eligible if they spent time south of Canal Street. So a lot of work and effort will go in to find witnesses, people shop below Canal Street, do banking, visit friends, would go out to dinner, do their food shopping, things of this nature. It adds up. So we urge people that if they look at the map and say, oh, I was a couple blocks outside of the zone, and now I have one of the 69 cancers, still call, still question, because you'll be surprised how many people do meet the criteria because they were in the zone for the required amount of time, even if they lived or worked right outside of it.
And that's what I want to talk about. There's so many questions. Sorry. One of the things is that we have around a 90% engagement of first responders, because often if you are on the job for the fire department or police department, you have the regular physicals related to work. So there's a kind of connection there. So we have a high percentage of participation with first responders who now have moved all around the country with retirement. What is the situation? It's much different for civilian survivors, right? It's like something like 10%. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that are not aware that they are eligible for this program.
Absolutely. And that's why, Farish McGarry, we try to do so much outreach. One of our main mottos is help us spread the word. And that's what you're doing today. And that's what I hope all the listeners do today. Think about the 500,000 people below Canal Street during the 8 months after September 11th. They certainly still don't reside in New York. People move away. We have clients in every state. We have clients in different countries. And people think 9/11 is a New York problem. It isn't. It's actually a global problem because people who were in New York, left New York, and might live in Florida or California, they don't get the 9/11 news like New Yorkers do. They don't hear it. They are not. They're not reminded of it every time they look up at the skyline and see the missing towers or see the Freedom Tower. So spreading the word and letting people know, oh, you have now, you have uterine cancer and you went to school in Lower Manhattan, you should find out if you're eligible. You now.
Yeah, and there's 19,000 to 20,000 school kids. I guess is just K through 12. There's 19,000. We've had Lila Nordstrom on from Sky Health. Yeah. Yeah.
At my law school, I went to New York Law School on Worth Street. I was in the zone. They reopened my school 2 weeks later. My law school was packed. We were breathing in the same dust. Those particles were settling on our skin. We were absorbing it in, and we were told we had to go back to school. We didn't have a choice. We were told
to get back to normal.
There.
Go ahead. I was going to ask you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, you know, schools opened 2 weeks later, but all the businesses, including stock market and everything, you know, opened a week later. And, you know, so it was just 1 week later that we were all down there. So it's, you know, talking about the dust, I can remember them coming to clean my office windowsills where, you know, there was 2 inches, maybe 3 inches of dust all along the windowsill. And I said to the gentleman who came, they came and opened the windows, I said, you know, be careful with that dust. That's you know, people. It's not just the buildings. It's not just the paper. It's not just, you know, the glass. It's not just, there are people in that dust. And
so you had such a common sense take on this. I'm just wondering, I've gone down to the World Trade Center and interviewed people from around the world because it's become such a focus for international visitors. And the thing that surprises me is I would say almost a parallel narrative. People have no idea that the death toll from 9/11 has now surpassed the number of people lost for these occupational exposures and community health-based exposures. Is that, I mean, do you find yourself often having to educate people that it is still an ongoing issue even today?
I mean, definitely, you know, my family and friends and circle know that. And, you know, we're good friends with a retired police officer, and he's lost 10 friends. And we had dinner last night, and he told us a story of number 10, who died last week, and he went to his services on Saturday this weekend. And so it is, you know, very real to those of us who live in the area, worked in the area, and still maintain connections. And as you said, Sarah, trying to get the word out, I think, is so important because so many people have left the area. You know, in your prime working years, and during that occurrence, you're still working or maybe getting ready to retire. Plus, all of the young people, children, young children, young adults.
Excuse me, we have a caller on the line. There are stockholders, sure. So we have to take the call. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind, and what's your name?
Yes, good morning. I'm wondering if people old enough to remember when America's mayor, during the time of the 9/11 incident, advised people not to evacuate the building. I'm wondering what was his rationale to tell people not to leave the buildings, to stay in place. I don't hear about that much, and nobody has questioned the former mayor about that decision to not leave the buildings. I heard it. I heard him actually state it, and I'm wondering how many people remember that.
We're up against the clock. I will answer that because I don't think thank you so much for calling. One of the things was that the conventional wisdom had always been shelter in place. And many things were revealed to be totally disastrous. And one of them was, for instance, the 911 operators were not able to provide that information of what they were hearing from people in the buildings to first responders. The radios failed across the board, like we even see with the COVID response. Government failed us in a profound way. Sarah, I want to ask you, how can people get in touch with you? And are there any other illnesses that you're working on to get recognized?
So the first part of the question is we do have a big media presence because we are trying to reach every single person that has a question. You can Google our name, Barash, Barasch McGarry, McGarry. You can call us 888-351-9421. You can call my direct line, 212-385-8155. If you want to speak to us, you will speak to us. We return calls literally 24/7 every day of the year.
Thank you so much for calling. Karen Smith-Hagen, I'd like to have you back on with a panel of other folks who are doing the kind of outreach work. Would you be amenable? There's retired corps officers, firefighters, students. I really think that what you have to say could really help them.
Sure, I'd be happy to help in any way I can. Like I said, it's important to get the word out, make sure women get the recognition, you know, that they need to get the care that they need. The care for cancer is expensive, not only financially, but emotionally. And making sure that everyone has access is important.
Thank you both so much for taking the time. That's Karen Smith-Hagen, 9/11 cancer survivor, and Sarah Director with Barash McGarry. Then remember, you get the world you fight for.
101.5 FM. WBAI, New York.
As New Yorkers, we like things fast. And when it comes to COVID-19, it's all about acting fast. Acting fast to get tested and treatment if you have COVID-19 symptoms. Treatment works best the sooner you start and can help you avoid serious illness. So act fast, especially if you're over 65 or have pre-existing conditions. Call your healthcare provider or 212-COVID-19 for testing and treatment options. And remember, COVID-19 vaccines are still the best protection against serious illness from the virus. Visit nyc.gov/vaccine finder today.
That message brought to you by the New York City Department of Health. This is WBAI New York.
The Vision Zero Initiative reminds you that speeding ruins lives. Drivers, always look for pedestrians and cyclists and slow your turns to 5 miles per hour.
Don't want to use the website or the call center to contribute to WBAI? That's okay. Please feel free to send your check or money order to WBAI, 3rd floor, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Please make your check or money order out to Pacifica-WBAI. We thank you for your donation and hope that you will spread the word and tell your friends. And please keep on listening.
Raising money today for the Tower Fund here at WBAI.
And without that tower, we can't stay on the air.
Please, just give what you can.
And those contributions can be small or they can be large, but those are the contributions that we need to make in order to beat back the other side. No one is going to do it for us.
Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air.
Let's face it, without Pacifica, what do you have? NPR is two milquetoast. PBS, two milquetoast. Without Pacifica, we're dead in the water.
And that pledge line is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950.
And we're only asking those who can give it, those who can afford it. We know that there's some people out there who cannot afford it, and that's one of the problems. Those of us who relatively have must stand up for those who have not.
I'm sick and tired hearing people complain about, well, you know, the right wing has Fox News and they have this and they have that. The oppressor always has more money than the oppressed. We have to make use of the resources that we have. We have people and we have people that can make contributions.
Here on WBAI 99.5 FM, we want to have the Tower Fund strong and healthy so we're not worried about it.
212-209-2950. Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the Tower Fund.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, January 24th at 9 p.m. will be joined by filmmakers Stephen Fischler and Joe Sucher to discuss their films on American radicalism, including From Swastika to Jim Crow and Red Squad, among the latest streaming releases from Ovid's collection, Anarchy in the USA.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
Yes, they're radical cats.
Aren't they all?
Ah, not so strange to find you here. I'd like to try to persuade you to contribute at least a dollar or two to the meager coffers of WBAI, terrestrial radio station. And what do you suppose your dollars could do to horrify corporate media with an alternative to their narrative? You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
Extinction Diaries. Tropical waters at the equator are known to be the richest and most stable diversity in the oceans. However, a research study released in spring of 2021 has concluded that the data indicates that stability and diversity has changed. There is an increasing exodus of marine life fleeing the equator. In fact, the equator is no longer the dominant bulk of diversity. Fossil records indicate that species flee for cooler waters. Many, if not most, species will disappear. Scientists warn that a similar warming as we are seeing today occurred some 250 million years ago, and over 90% of marine life died. Of course, this means dire consequences for humans that include harvesting food and tourism. Entire nations depending on fishing and tourism will find themselves without. There has never been a clearer reason to protect and conserve marine areas, and to ensure as much life as possible enter into the migrations that can no longer be averted. 5 years ago, scientists warned ocean warming could reach a tipping point that could make the marine die-off unstoppable. The findings of this study should raise alarm bells in every human head and heart across the world. My name is Arne Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Hey, this is Shaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hey, this is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Same great soulful sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio. Sweet Tuesday, darling Tuesday.
Tuesday. Hey. This is Michael, a BAI buddy from Brooklyn. WBAI, oh, WBAI, you're listening to WBAI. 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Listen and learn. And become a BAI buddy today.
WBAI New York, we're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.com.